ain't heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino. Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
This is Hidden Killers Half Year in Review. A look back at some of the most compelling cases of 2026 so far. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Rob Reiner was 78 years old. His wife, Michelle, was 68. And on Saturday night, December 13th, they brought their 32-year-old son to a Christmas party at Conan O'Brien's house because they needed to keep an eye on him. Let that just sink in for a quick second here. One of the most successful directors in Hollywood history, the guy who made The Princess Bride, When Harry Met Sally, A Few Good Men, spent what would be the last night of his life functioning as a babysitter for his grown-ass adult son at a party full of A-list celebrities because that's what the system left him with. Not treatment options, not institutional support, not legal authority. And that's the key thing here, to intervene in his son's obvious mental health crisis. Just proximity, just being in the room, just hoping that his presence would be enough to keep things from going sideways. And it wasn't. This is not a rich people problem, a poor people problem, a middle class, this problem and that problem. It's an every person problem when it comes to addiction. You can have all the resources in the world, and this case shows us that, and you still can't shield someone from their own demons if they don't want to get out of the hellscape. And there's nothing you can do in this country to force them to get the help and to be in a safe environment if they don't want it to be. You just get to sit there and wait for their ticking time bomb personality of a self to explode. Or you can abandon them and hope they just go die on the street or get their shit together and come back and figure their shit out. Or just keep doing the same cycle over and over and over and over until you die as a caregiver. Because there's nothing one can legally do when you see someone spiraling out of control, having a pattern of being out of control, being a danger to themselves or others, unless that's an imminent danger in that moment. And even then, you get like a 72-hour hold. And then, well, he was in the corner for a little bit, put him in timeout, everything's going to be good. This is how we treat mental health crises in America and many other countries, I'm learning, as we've been covering this case and you guys have been reaching out. Let's talk about this. Nick Reiner spent that party acting erratically. And I'm sure he spent the days leading up to that party acting erratically. Allegedly staring at people, exhibiting what witnesses called antisocial behavior. At one point, he allegedly interrupted a private conversation involving Bill Hader. When Hader told him it was private, Nick reportedly stood there frozen, staring before storming off. And I said this in a short the other day. It has nothing to do with Bill Hader. He could have been talking to Snuckles the cat, and it would have had the same effect. When an addict and a mentally ill person is out for a fight, they're out to be the victim. And they're searching for someone to, quote, victimize them simply by maybe looking at them, maybe correcting them, maybe saying, hey, there's a boundary here. I'm having a conversation, a private one at that. They're looking for some reason to be the one that was pushed off, pushed away, so they can justify their own horrible behaviors and unhealthy ways of thinking. And yeah, and at the time, they're not aware they're doing it. That's part of the disease. That's part of the addiction. That's part of the mental illness. But just know, this has nothing to do with Bill Hader. It has nothing to do with how he was treated at a party. Simply being told, hey, private conversation. Thanks. Where most people will go, oh, my bad. Not this guy. So I just want to make that clear. Whoever happened to be at the wrong place at the wrong time when Nick wanted to become a victim would have been that random person. It doesn't matter. After that came the argument, loud enough for the whole party to hear, allegedly. Rob and Michelle left afterward. Less than 24 hours later, both of them were dead. Throat slit, multiple stab wounds found by their daughter, Romy, in their Brentwood home, which was still decorated for Christmas. Nick was arrested shortly thereafter. He's now being held without bail and charged with murder. And here's the thing that's going to haunt me about this case. Not just the violence, not just the brutality, but the sheer predictability of it. How everyone saw this coming. The family saw it. The friends saw it. Nick himself probably saw it. Michelle had been telling people for months that she and Rob were at their wits' end. Her exact words, according to sources, we've tried everything. And they had. For 17 years, they tried everything. And their son and our system gave them nothing in return except the privilege of watching their son deteriorate while being legally prohibited from doing anything about it. This is the reality. And maybe you already know it, and maybe you already feel it, and you're like, yes, I've been screaming this forever, and no one seems to care. Well, let's try and use this as a learning moment, as an educational moment for everyone else out there who has somehow in their mind a rosy picture of when somebody is this bad, this struggling, this mentally ill, this addicted, that somehow there's this system that swoops in and you can keep them safe and protected from themselves and others, especially if you have a ton of money. The reality is, no, you don't. You may have all the money, but the system, this rosy-colored glasses view that somehow they will be protected from their own demons, does not exist. You can love that person quite literally to death. And there's nothing you can do to protect them or stop them. We don't allow for it because they have rights too. They have autonomy. While everyone else sits around watching the house burn. And they're screaming, put more fire on it! And you're like, well, really, we should probably use more water. Let's get some water. Nope, you're not allowed to use that hose over there. Well, why not? Because what if they want to take a sip from it? What if they want to have some delicious hose water? Well, we need to put the fire out. Well, they're drinking from the hose right now, so you better just let them have their sip. It's bureaucracy, it's ignorance, it's a blind desire to respect everyone's rights when we simply can't accept that there are some people in our society that don't deserve rights. They have forfeited those time and time again through their actions, through their illness, through their addiction. And at some point, the grown-ups in the room do need to step in and say, hey, you know, this freedom that you have to continue destroying your lives and everyone else who's around it, that needs to stop. And until you can start demonstrating that, you know, you're not going to do this, you're going to lose some of those privileges or rights. But we don't do that. We wait until this happens. And then, well, better lock him up. Yeah, maybe we should have done that a long time ago. Maybe some people are simply clear and present dangers to themselves and others, and we all know it, but we like to pretend and hope, they'll get better. This'll work, that'll work. So, and when it doesn't, you end up babysitting your 32-year-old son at a black tie Christmas party while he's wearing a hoodie, offending people and acting like a jackass. Nick Reiner's struggles started in his teens. He went to his first rehab program at 15. By the time he was 19, he'd cycled through 17 different treatment facilities. 17. He spent stretches of time homeless in Maine, New Jersey, Texas, sleeping on the streets, living in shelters, a kid from one of the wealthiest families in Hollywood. And he was out there on the concrete because the programs weren't working and he didn't want to do the work or go back. In 2016, he told People magazine what it was like. Quote, when I was out there, I could have died, he said. It's all luck. You roll the dice and you hope you make it. His parents knew the stakes. They knew everything they had going on here. They threw everything they had at the problem, money, connections, access to the best treatment programs in the country. They hired the experts. They followed the protocols. They did what they were told. And in 2015, Rob said something publicly that retrospectively, when you look at this, you go, God damn. The addiction had already won by 2015. It had convinced Rob and his wife that listening to doctors, listening to professionals was the wrong thing. That they should have been listening to their son all along, that would make it better. Addicts manipulate, addicts lie, addicts will tell you anything and try to get you to do anything for them. You be damned. You can die in the process. It don't matter. As long as they're getting what they want. That's the nature of addiction. That's the nature of certain mental illnesses. It just is what it is. It's not really up for debate. He said when Nick would tell us that it wasn't working for him, we wouldn't listen. And you know what? You shouldn't have. We were desperate. And because the people had diplomas on their wall, we listened to them when we should have been listening to our son. No, you should have never been listening to your addict son tell you that treatment is not working. It wasn't working. He chose not to make it work. Michelle said something similar. We were so influenced by these people. They would tell us he's a liar, that he was trying to manipulate us, and we believed them. They were right. No amount of love, no amount of movie making, no amount of documentaries, no amount of let's pull him in here and try to connect. And I do not fault Rob for doing any of this. They were hitting walls everywhere with a son who refused to get the help, take the help, and do the work. And he manipulated his parents enough for them to think that his choice not to do those things was not the problem. It was the doctors that were telling him what they needed to do that was the problem. That is a successful manipulation by an addict. It is not shaming the victims here whatsoever. It is looking back at the documented history and calling it what it is. Let it be a cautionary tale for anyone out there who's dealing with an addict who is mentally ill in their life that is trying to be sold a bill of goods on how the treatment is the problem, not them. That quote has been circulating out there for the last several days as evidence of the Reiner's self-awareness, their willingness to acknowledge mistakes, and look, that's true. It's good to take a look at things, and not every treatment program works. But 17, this is someone who didn't want to get help. There is another way to read this as an indictment of a system that gives families two options. You defer to the experts while hoping that the addict will go along with it, because that's the other key part of this. If the addict, the mentally ill person, doesn't want to participate, you can't force them to participate. So you kind of had to have two things going at once. Number one, you have to be able to afford it. Number two, the person that's getting the help needs to want it. And if they don't, you have to go it alone because you can't force them. So they end up on the streets like he did. They tried that. Let him hit absolute rock bottom. Maybe that will wake him up. Maybe that will make something change. It didn't. Again, this is not something that can be solved with money, and this proves it. This is not something that can be solved with love, with tough love, with extra love, with making a movie, with relating, with connecting. This is something that either that addict will get the help they need or go down a path by their choice or the way it sits right now, you basically wait for death and destruction. There used to be that middle ground. There used to be hospitals, mental health facilities that people like this would go to, would be forced to go to, didn't have a choice because the people around them cared enough and said, this is a dangerous person. Now, yes, we can go down the road of were some horrible, were they abused, were this, yes, there was horrible situations and there was wonderful ones too. So to throw the baby out with the bathwater and say, well, we've tried that in the past. We've tried a lot of things in the past. We can go back. We can revisit. We can do things better. I feel like at 2025, we could maybe retake this and do in a little more professional, educated, compassionate way than we did maybe 50, 60 years ago. Just saying, it might be a little more compassionate than watching people wither away on the streets, dying, raising children in tents. I don't know, just saying. The Reiners deferred. They initially trusted the programs. They believed the professionals. And when those specific programs didn't work, again and again, they felt that they were left with nothing but guilt and a son who was still sick. What were they supposed to do instead? Lock him in a room? Can't do that. He's an adult. And the law said he had the right to make his own decisions. Even if those decisions were killing him. Even if those decisions would eventually kill them. This isn't an indictment on the mental health system in America. And what we like to pretend is passable and is okay and acceptable. This is how it works, and I'm using it. That term works in the loosest possible sense. If someone you love is mentally ill, addicted, psychotic, dangerous, all of the above, they check all the boxes, your options are essentially zero. You can beg them to get help. You can pay for treatment. You can drive them to the hospital. But unless they agree to go or unless they meet a very specific legal threshold, you cannot force them there. That threshold is imminent danger to self or others, and courts interpret that phrase as narrowly as possible. Your son is delusional? Delusional? Not enough. Your daughter is using heroin? Not enough. Your husband is threatening violence? Well, unless he's making specific credible threats against specific people in that exact moment, probably not enough. In California, where the Reiners live, you can get someone placed in a 5150 hold, involuntary psychiatric detention, but that lasts 72 hours max. 3 days, and trust me, after about 24 hours, most hospitals are like, how quick can we get this person out of here? Then they're released. unless they meet that criteria all over again, and then the clock just starts up again. Over and over and over. How quickly can this person be healed? That's not how healing works. So families end up in this insane loop. Crisis, hospital, hold, release, deterioration. Crisis, hospital, hold, release, deterioration. Over and over with no resolution, no long-term plan, and no meaningful intervention. The system isn't designed to treat mental illness. It's designed to manage liability. Hospitals don't want to hold patients longer than necessary. Courts don't want to violate civil liberties. Insurance companies don't want to pay for extended care, and families are left holding the bag. Responsible for someone they have no legal authority over, no clinical training to help, and no institutional support to rely on. This is what the Reiners were living with for 17 years. The roots of this disaster go back to the 60s and the 70s when America decided to empty out its state psychiatric hospitals. This'll work great, won't it? The intentions were good, some people thought. The institutions had become warehouses, overcrowded, underfunded, rife with abuse. Patients were drugged into oblivion and left to rot. The civil rights movement rightfully demanded change. People with mental illnesses deserve dignity, and they do. But then, just as one system had gone so far this way, we swung it so far the other way. And we said, you deserve the rights of every single free American out there. Even though you can't handle that, you'll probably kill yourself or others along the way. But we're going to do this. So the hospitals closed. Between 1955 and 1994, the number of patients in state psychiatric facilities dropped from over 500,000 to under 70,000. They didn't take a look at the system and go, how can we do this better? They just said, we're closed for business. And what happened after that? Well, look to any sweet street corner or tent community. They're about 12 generations in now. The plan was to replace institutional care with community mental health centers, outpatient treatment, supportive housing, wraparound services. What a lovely idea. And then they said, and you know who's going to pay for all this? Communities, you know, where we used to take care of this on a state level or a federal level. Okay, now every individual community, you get to foot the bill for this. And all the communities said, we'll pass. We'll put something up that kind of looks like a mental health facility, but then it's really not going to be a mental health. It's going to kind of like, you know. So the funding never materialized, and the centers were never built, and the services never arrived. What we got instead was homelessness, incarceration, and families turned into unpaid psychiatric wards. Today, the largest mental health facilities in America are jails. Cook County Jail in Chicago, Rikers Island in New York, Los Angeles County Jail. That's where the mentally ill end up, or on the streets, not because they're criminals sometimes, but because there's nowhere else for them to go. And the ones who don't end up in jail, they end up on the streets or in emergency rooms or in their parents' guest houses, getting high for days on end and punching holes in walls. Or in their basement or in that extra bedroom, or maybe in the bedroom that the parents give the addict child while they sleep on the couch. Because they're trying everything to make that addict comfortable and to get better. Hoping that today isn't the day that their lives are stolen from them by a mad person. In 2018, Nick Reiner appeared on the podcast called Dopey. It's about addiction and recovery and describing being sequestered in his parents' guest house. Yes, sequestered. He talked about getting totally spun out on uppers, being awake for days and destroying the place, punching out the TV, smashing lamps, going off the rails, while his parents watched helplessly from the main house. What were they supposed to do? Call the cops on their son for property damage? It would get him $5,150 for the 100th time. only to have him released 72 hours later. The system had no answers. So Rob and Michelle did the only thing they could. They managed. They monitored. They kept an eye on him. And they even started to believe the addiction and the bullshit that the addiction told his son to tell them until they couldn't anymore. There's a philosophy behind the way we handle mental illness in this country, and it sounds reasonable until you actually see it in practice. The idea is autonomy. Every adult has the right to make their own decisions, including decisions about their own health care. You don't force treatment on someone just because you think they need it. That would be paternalistic, would violate their civil liberties. That would be a step back towards the bad old days of involuntary institutionalization. It sounds, you know, lovely on paper until you actually interact with an addict or someone who's mentally ill and you go, oh, there's a reason there's these kind of structures and boundaries and barriers up. Because they just blaze through them. They don't respect them. They don't care about them. They can't process how healthy individuals live. But here's the problem. When someone is in active psychosis or deep in addiction or experiencing a severe mental health crisis, their decision-making capacity, in case we didn't realize this, is a little compromised. It's not a moral judgment. It's neuroscience. The brain is not functioning correctly. They are not capable of making rational choices about their own care. This is where humanity should be stepping in saying, we need to help you. But we've created laws that prevent us from being able to do that. The law treats them as if they are okay. A person whose cognition is severely impaired is given full legal authority over their own treatment. They can refuse medication, they can walk out of hospitals, they can reject every intervention their family tries to arrange. Meanwhile, the people who love them, who can see the deterioration, who live with the consequences, who are terrified of what's coming, have no legal standing whatsoever. The system prioritizes the autonomy of the sick over the safety and sanity of everyone around them. And families aren't caregivers in this framework. They are hostages. That's the word that keeps coming back to me. Hostages. Think about what that family and families in this situation actually experience. They walk on eggshells constantly, trying not to trigger an episode. They monitor behavior around the clock with no authority to intervene. They watch someone they love destroy themselves in slow motion and are told by a system that there's nothing to be done. The financial toll is staggering. Treatment programs, legal fees, property damage, lost income, the emotional toll? Well, that's priceless. Guilt, fear, exhaustion, isolation, the constant low-grade terror of waiting for the next crisis. And the physical danger is real, too. They're living with someone who is unpredictable, someone who may become violent, someone who has already demonstrated that they are not in control. Rob Reiner was 78 years old. Michelle was 68. They were not equipped to physically manage a 32-year-old man in crisis. No one that age is. But the system said it was their job. Actually, the system just said, good fucking luck. I'm out. Nick was an adult. Because Nick had rights, because forcing treatment would be wrong somehow. So they brought him to a Christmas party to keep an eye on him. Because that's all they were allowed to do. I want to address something that people don't like to say out loud. Not everyone can be saved. Not everyone can be saved. The mental health system operates on the assumption that recovery is always possible, that the right treatment, the right support, the right intervention, anyone can get better. That's a comforting belief. It's also not true. Some people are too sick. Some addictions are too entrenched. Some brains are too damaged. Some individuals will never achieve stability, no matter how many resources are thrown at them. I'm not saying we shouldn't try. I'm not saying we should abandon people. But I am saying that the system's refusal to acknowledge this reality puts families in an impossible position. They're told to keep trying, to never give up, to believe that this program, this medication, this intervention will be the one that finally works. And when it doesn't, when the 17th rehab fails, just like the first 16, they're left with nothing but guilt and the question of what they did wrong. Well, they didn't do anything wrong. The Reiners tried for 17 years. They had every resource available, money, connections, access, love. They made mistakes, sure, they've admitted as much, but they also did everything the system told them to do. And in the end, their son killed them, allegedly. At what point does a family have the right to protect themselves? At what point does endless patience become complicity in their own destruction? And at what point does the system's commitment to autonomy become a death sentence for the people trying to help? There are laws that could make a difference. Assisted outpatient treatment programs, court-ordered treatment for people who meet specific criteria. Kendra's law in New York, Laura's law in California. They allow judges to mandate treatment for individuals with a history of hospitalization, incarceration, or violence related to mental illness. They aren't exercised very often. Sometimes they work. The data shows reduced hospitalization, reduced homelessness, reduced incarceration, reduced violence, but they are chronically underfunded and underutilized because the mental health advocacy community has spent decades fighting against anything that smells like coercion. The concerns are legitimate. The history of psychiatric abuse is real. Racial disparities and involuntary commitments are documented. The potential for misuse certainly exists, but the current system isn't protecting anyone. It's not protecting the mentally ill who cycle through ERs and jails and end up dead on the streets. It's not protecting families who are left to manage impossible situations with no support, and it's not protecting the public who bear the consequences when untreated mental illness turns violent. We emptied the hospitals because they were inhumane, but we didn't replace them with anything better. We just shifted the burden onto families and called it freedom. I keep coming back to that image of Rob and Michelle at that Christmas party. 78, 68, surrounded by celebrities trying to keep their son from making a scene. That was their Saturday night. That was their life. Not retirement, not grandchildren, not enjoying the fruits of a legendary career, just management, surveillance, damage control. They left the party after the argument, and we're learning more about the whereabouts of Nick after, as the days move on. And then their daughter found them dead. And she knew immediately who was responsible. She told the police her brother was dangerous and that he should be a suspect, allegedly. The family had known for years what Nick was capable of. They just couldn't do anything about it because the system said they couldn't, because Nick had rights, because autonomy matters more than outcomes. Rob Reiner directed some of the most beloved films of the last 50 years. He changed the ending of When Harry Met Sally because he believed in happy endings. He believed people could find their way to each other. He did not get a happy ending. Neither did Michelle. Neither did Nick, really. Whatever happens to him now, his life is effectively over. The only people who win in this story are the ones who get to keep pretending the system works. The advocates who fight against involuntary treatment, the politicians who underfund mental health services, the hospitals that discharge patients after 72 hours because that's what the law requires. They'll move on to the next case, the next tragedy, the next family destroyed by a system that prioritizes philosophy over reality. And somewhere right now, another family is living the same nightmare, watching a loved one spiral, begging for help, being told there's nothing to be done. bringing their adult child to a social event just to keep an eye on them, because that's all the law allows. The Reiners had everything, money, access, connections, and love, and the system still failed them. And it will keep failing families until we admit the truth, that autonomy without capacity isn't freedom. It's abandonment. And forcing families to wait for tragedy isn't compassion. It's cowardice, dressed up as civil liberties. Rob and Michelle Reiner deserve better. So does every family still trapped in this nightmare, waiting for a system that will never come to save them. Your thoughts in the comments section on YouTube. I would love to see them. Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi is where you will find us. We do greatly appreciate those comments and your feedback. We do read them. So thank you in advance for that. And if you don't mind, Apple Podcasts, if you like what we're doing, leave us a review. We do greatly appreciate that as well. Until next time, my name is Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Back in 2015, Rob Reiner sat down with the Los Angeles Times and said something that in hindsight is, it's almost unbearable to read. And this is not in any way to blame him, but hindsight is always 20/20. And as I've said from the beginning on this case, let this be a cautionary tale, because it's already a horrific tragedy for so many people. If we can find any sort of silver lining in this, it's being able to identify the problems here, what took place, what could maybe have been done differently to produce a different outcome. Because I think a lot of people are seeing the story and feeling the story and going, oh my God, this hits home in ways you can't even imagine. Because everybody's experience with individuals like this, with addicts, mentally ill people, can be dramatically different, because the disease can be so crazy. But at the same point, very similar as well. So let's get into this part here. And if you don't mind, while you're listening, please do hit subscribe wherever it's at. If it's YouTube, search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Same search on the podcast platforms. It allows other folks to know that we exist. You doing that signals, hey, people are interested in this and people are finding this valuable. Then other folks find it and it can be valuable and helpful to other people too. So thank you for that in advance. Okay. He was promoting Being Charlie, Rob was, a semi-autobiographical film that he directed about his son Nick's battle with addiction. And he wanted to make something clear. The professionals had been wrong. You know, at that moment in time, people listened to him and going, oh my gosh, really? Tell me more. Because at that moment in time, in that little aversion to insanity that Nick's life had been on, it was a little bit of a divergent upswing. It was a moment of stability somewhat compared to the chaos that had been. And he was looking at this moment of stability going, look at this, we tried it this way. And now he's okay. But as many of us know, and as they soon learned after, those moments of stability with an addict, mentally ill individual, they don't last long. He said, when Nick would tell us that it wasn't working for him, the rehab, we wouldn't listen, Rob said. We were desperate. And because the people had diplomas on their wall, we listened to them. We should have been listening to our son. His wife, Michelle, went further, said, we were so influenced by these people. She said, they would tell us he's a liar, that he's trying to manipulate us, and we believe them. And 10 years later, we know what happened. Rob and Michelle Reiner are now dead, stabbed to death in their Brentwood home, allegedly by that same son, the son the counselors warned them about, the son they publicly defended, the son they kept in a guest house on their property because they didn't know what else to do. And look, they had tried everything. In case you're new to this story and like, well, it's not a great idea to do that, they already tried to let him go live on the streets. Hit rock bottom. See what happens. He survived. He came back. Seemed to be doing a little bit better. And then spiral down. This is a story about addiction, yes, but it's also a story about something far more uncomfortable. The way people in active addiction can rewrite the families who love them, rewrite their stories, rewire the families, even turning that love into a tool of control, isolation, and ultimately destruction. And it's a story about how sometimes, not always, but sometimes the most dangerous thing you can do for someone you love is refuse to walk away. Nick Reiner first went to rehab at 15 years old. By his own account, he cycled through 17 or 18 facilities over the next several years. Heroin, cocaine, those are the allegations, whatever else was available. He experienced periods of homelessness in Maine, New Jersey, and Texas, not because his family abandoned him, but because he refused to go to the programs they recommended. Quote, if I wanted to do it my way and not go to the programs they were suggesting, then I had to be homeless, he told People magazine. Back in 2016, he said that, almost 10 years ago. He framed this as his parents' fault. The implicit message was clear. You made me live on the streets because you wouldn't let me do recovery my own way. Yeah, because you know what? Recovery for a mentally ill addict, their own way, doesn't mean recovery. This is how it works. The addict learns to flip the script. The family sets the boundary. You need to go to treatment. And the addict responds by escalating the stakes. Fine, I'll be homeless. I'll sleep on the streets. I could die out there. And suddenly the boundary isn't about protecting the family anymore. It's about whether the family is willing to let their child die. And most parents aren't, rightfully so. So they capitulate. They let him come home. They try another approach. They listen to him this time. Nick learned to work the system early. On the Dopey podcast in 2018, an addiction-focused show where he'd appeared multiple times, he admitted he'd figured out how to navigate rehab without actually committing to recovery. He also admitted he wasn't sober at the time of the interview. He was smoking a little weed, taking a little Adderall. He said the weed was a preventative measure to keep him off harder drugs. And he casually mentioned that about a year and a half earlier, he got back on dope and other things and suffered what he called a cocaine heart attack on a cross-country flight during an intervention. He woke up in a hospital in Boston. But the host asked if he had any parting words for the listeners. Nick said, I have no parting words, just everybody use or don't use, whatever. Sounds like someone really dedicated to his recovery, as everyone around them is, except the addict. And when that happens, you are literally left with no choice other than saying, there's a bridge down the road that might cover you from the rain. That is not a person in recovery. This is a person who has learned that the performance of recovery is enough to keep the money following, the housing secure, and the family engaged. The actual sobriety part to him, optional. The violence wasn't hidden. Nick talked openly about destroying his parents' guest house while high on stimulants. I got totally spun out on uppers. I think I was on coke and something else, and I was up for days on end, and I started punching out different things in my guest house. My guest house, like it's his. He said that on Dopey. I think I started with the TV, and then I went over to the lamp, and then just everything in the guest house got wrecked. He described it casually, almost proudly. I went 10 rounds with my guest house. This happened around the time his parents told him he had to leave and go back to rehab. So, in true addict form, he responded by destroying their property. And then presumably he went to rehab. And then he came back. And the cycle continued. A longtime neighbor of the Reiners told the New York Post after the murders, this is not the first time their son has been violent. I know of another incident a few years back with Nick, but I won't say more than that. I just never thought it would get to this point. An ex-classmate was more blunt. She said she instantly knew Nick was responsible when the deaths were announced as a homicide. A yoga instructor who worked with the family in the early 2000s was so affected by young Nick's screaming outbursts, episodes that could last 20 minutes or longer, that she wrote a children's book about it. The book was about a child with big feelings and even bigger energy who learns to calm down through yoga. It was her way of processing what she'd witnessed in that house. The warning signs weren't subtle. They were screaming. They had been screaming for years. Here's where this gets even more painful. The Reiners weren't naive. They spent years listening to the professionals. They sent Nick to facility after facility, following the advice of counselors and addiction specialists who told them the same thing over and over. Your son is lying to you. He is manipulating you. This is what addicts do. Don't believe the stories. Believe the pattern. And that's true in almost any line of humanity, addict or not. Believe the pattern when it deviates dramatically, especially even more on a healthy individual. Take a look at what's actually going on. Because actions do speak louder than words. And again, if this is speaking to you, don't let this just be a story you're hearing. Let this be information you take in and live by. If you are the caregiver for the addict, take this in as if we're speaking directly to you. I am not a medical professional. You should contact a doctor and do all that. But just take a listen to this, and as a human being, take this to heart. For a while, Rob and Michelle held that line. They enforced boundaries. They insisted on treatment even when Nick resisted. They let him be homeless rather than enable him on his terms. But somewhere along the way, something broke. By 2015, they had completely reversed course. They weren't just questioning the professionals anymore. They were publicly apologizing for ever trusting them. Rob said they should have been listening to our son instead of the people with diplomas on the wall. Michelle said the counselors had convinced them Nick was a liar and a manipulator, and they regretted believing it. Successful manipulation by an addict. Check. And the addict knew it, and those around him who loved him and sacrificed everything for him, they could not see the forest before the trees. He had them bamboozled. And I can guarantee if that addict in your life is not actively in treatment and working on their lifelong recovery, you may start saying it that way too. Because what do? When you try this, you try that, you try everything. Well, the doctor route isn't working. The route for rehabs isn't working. What is he saying that might work for him? What does work? An addict who actively is wanting to participate in their own recovery. And that's about it. They have to make that choice. You can't make it for them. You can't force it on them. We have a system, and we talked about this in a video yesterday, where if they don't want the treatment, your options are pretty slim to nil. Yes, you can force 72-hour holds. Yes, you can do these temporary things this way and that way. But unless, as we've learned, unless they are in imminent danger to themselves or others, and the law is pretty clear on that, it's like literally having the weapon in their hand. If they're just hinting at it, if they're violent, if they're demonstrating behavior that could easily escalate to the next level, that's not enough to commit them beyond their will That gets you a 72-hour hold, maybe. Within the first few hours of being in whatever facility they go to, that facility's like, how quick can we get this person out of here? Maybe within 24 hours you'll get out. You never know. And you know what? They know how to work the shit because they've been in and out of it. In his case, 17 times by his late teens. God knows how many by 32. They know how to successfully manipulate that system. And when they actually get the people who love them the most to believe that true help is the wrong answer, that is how successful manipulation looks when it's complete. The addict doesn't just get the family to doubt their professionals. He gets them to feel guilty for ever having believed anyone but him. He becomes the victim of a system that tried to help him, and the family becomes complicit in that victimization by having participated in it. The only way to make amends? Trust him. Give him another chance. This time it'll be different. The Reiners made a movie about it. They went on a press tour together. They told the story Nick wanted told, that the treatment industry had failed him, that his parents had failed him by believing the treatment industry, and that the real path to healing was the family finally seeing things his way, which is the biggest line of bullshit I've ever seen. I'm not blaming Rob for making that movie. If your child is literally dying in front of you, you're going to try every damn thing. And if one of the levers on your repertoire of things you can do is make a movie when you pull it, then you're going to take that lever. Well, maybe this creative process, maybe we could bond together. I get the thought process. And if Nick had actively wanted to be in recovery and work on his sobriety and that movie together, it could have ended in a very beautiful way. But it didn't, because he didn't want to. And here we are. Being Charlie Enns with the reconciliation, the father and son came together. The system is blamed. The family is magically healed and everything is great. But that's not real life. In real life, there is no reconciliation. There was just a guest house on a property and a son who never really left and parents who couldn't bring themselves to make him. I want to be clear about something here again. Rob and Michelle Reiner were not stupid. They were not weak. They were not bad parents. They were parents in an impossible situation facing a problem that has no reliable solution. They had resources most families can only dream of: money, connections, access to the best treatment programs in the country, and none of it worked because there is no amount of money that can force an adult to get sober. There is no treatment program that succeeds on someone who doesn't want it to succeed. There is no love powerful enough to override another person's autonomy, even when that autonomy is being used to destroy them. I'd rather have you alive and hating me than dead in the streets, the Rob Reiner character says in Being Charlie. That line came from real life. That was the philosophy the Reiners lived by for a time. Keep him close, keep him alive, even if he hates you for it, even if it costs you everything. A family friend told reporters after the murders, they did everything for Nick. Every treatment program, therapy sessions, and put aside their lives to save Nick's repeatedly. I've never known a family so dedicated to a child. To have it end this way is awful. According to law enforcement sources, the Reiners were finally pursuing a conservatorship over Nick at the time of their deaths. After nearly two decades of trying everything else, they had started the process of legally taking control of his life. And guess what? The system makes that next to impossible, too. Michelle had reportedly become increasingly concerned about his mental health in recent weeks. Something had shifted. They were finally taking the kind of drastic action the situation had demanded for years. They ran out of time. The night before the murders, Rob and Michelle attended that Christmas party at Conan O'Brien's house. And believe me, I didn't have Conan O'Brien Christmas party on my murder Christmas card of the year or my murder bingo sheet of events that were going to take place at all. Where somehow Conan O'Brien's name comes up in a true crime story about his Christmas party. But here we are. They allegedly asked the host if they could bring Nick. According to sources who spoke to Rolling Stone, the reason was simple. They wanted to keep an eye on him. Think about that for a moment. A holiday party with friends, black ties, a wonderful gala. And the primary concern is monitoring your 32-year-old son's behavior, making sure he doesn't do something that embarrasses the family or worse. And it didn't work. Multiple witnesses reported that Nick displayed antisocial behavior at the party. He was seen wandering alone, looking flat and emotionless. A loud argument broke out between Nick and his father. The family left shortly after. Embarrassment. Sometime in the early morning hours of December 14th, according to prosecutors, Nick Reiner allegedly stabbed both his parents to death inside their home. Their daughter, Romy, found the bodies Sunday afternoon. Nick was taken into custody later near USC. He did not resist. As you know, he's now facing two counts of first-degree murder with special circumstances, the use of a deadly weapon. The charges carry a maximum sentence of life without parole or the death penalty. Prosecutors haven't decided yet which they'll seek. Nick's defense attorney, Alan Jackson, who successfully defended Karen Reed in another high-profile case, has indicated that mental health will likely be central to the defense. Nick wasn't medically cleared to appear at his initial arraignment, though the reason for that has not officially been disclosed. Here's the part nobody wants to say out loud. Somebody, or sometimes, rather, sometimes the most loving thing you can do with an addict acting out in the way Nick was, is walk away. Not because you don't care. Not because you've given up. But because staying has become the thing that's killing both of you. Because your presence, your resources, your home, your hope, your sanity, all of it has become fuel for their destruction. And yours. When we're giving all of ourselves to someone that only takes and is incapable of not only receiving, also giving back. When we give and give and give and give, guess who wins and guess who loses here? It ain't the person that's giving all of themselves. And the addict, the word there is incapable. Incapable of receiving. Some just are. And that's a hard reality nobody wants to wrestle with. And I cannot imagine wrestling with that if it was my own kid. That is the hard reality, though, that some parents are forced to face, even when they've done everything right and their hearts are in the right place. When someone destroys your property while high and frames it as your fault for setting boundaries, that's a message. When someone has a documented history of volatility that neighbors and childhood acquaintances immediately recognize as a precursor to violence, that's a pattern. When professionals tell you this person is manipulating you and you respond by publicly apologizing for ever believing them, the manipulation has already won. There is a point where love becomes the weapon, and they use it against you, where every attempt to help becomes another opportunity for them to exploit your guilt, your hope, your refusal to give up, where the guest house in the backyard isn't a path to recovery. It's just proximity to the next crisis. They had a guest house. Most of us don't have a guest house. For many of us, this is happening in the bedroom across the hall. in the basement. And the extra couch in the living room. Making it even more dangerous. Rob and Michelle Reiner loved their son. That is not in question. They loved him enough to make a movie about his struggles, to sit next to him on press tours, to keep him close, even when they had every instinct and every professional telling them to create distance. They loved him enough to spend nearly 20 years trying to save him. And in the end, that love may have been the thing that kept them in range. There's a line in Being Charlie that reads differently now, the son character explaining why he used drugs. He says, "It was never about the drugs. It was all I ever wanted was a way to kill the noise. But the more I used, the louder it got. The noise never stopped. Not through 17 trips to rehab, not through the movie they made together, not through the years of living in the guest house, just steps away from parents who refused to give up on him. The noise just kept getting louder until it drowned out everything, including, allegedly, the lives of the two people who had sacrificed the most to keep it quiet. This isn't a story with a moral that fits on a bumper sticker. It's not a story that tells you what to do if someone you love is in active addiction. Every situation is different. Every family has to find their own limits. But it is a story that says this. Limits exist for a reason. Boundaries aren't abandonment. And sometimes the person who loves you the most is the person most vulnerable to the damage you can do." Rob and Michelle Reiner asked if they could bring Nick to a Christmas party so they could keep an eye on him. They were still watching, still hoping, and still trying. They were also, according to sources, finally pursuing the legal mechanism that might have forced real change, a conservatorship that would have taken decision-making power out of Nick's hands. Again, something nearly impossible to attain in many states. Does it exist? Yes. The way to get there, the path, the boxes you need to check that the court needs to also agree with, even if you have all the evidence, it ain't easy. We will never know if it would have worked. We only know that they didn't get the chance to find out. Sometimes letting go is the only way to survive, and sometimes even when you finally start to let go, it's already too late. Give me your thoughts in the comment section on YouTube. If you're not already there, search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. I would love to see what you guys have to say about all this. If this has reached you, if this has touched a nerve, and you would like to share your story, I would highly suggest doing it. In our comment section, because I can guarantee there's going to be a lot of people out there just like you reading and watching this. And that sense of community that I'm not alone, other people are going through this. While it seems like you are completely by yourself on that journey, you are not. This is just something a lot of people do not talk about a lot because it's traumatic. It's horrible. You don't want to relive the worst moments of your life over and over again. But if you have the courage to share your story in the comment section there on YouTube, I do highly encourage it. Again, it's about looking out there and taking something horrible and helping others find some good out of it. Whether that's just as a resource or whether it's just as another human being standing on this planet going, "You're not alone, I've been there too, here's my story." Again, you don't have to, but this would be a good platform if you'd want to make a difference where you have a lot of eyeballs all
kind of in the same place with a lot of people that have gone through the same things. So I do encourage that in the comment section. Please do press subscribe so you don't miss any of our commentary and our coverage of this case. We're going to obviously follow it all the way through. If you're on Apple Podcasts, please do press subscribe there as well. And if you don't mind, a review on Apple Podcasts would be greatly appreciated. Then it helps other folks in that platform over there also find us. It lets folks know that, hey, people are finding this material valuable. And then it feeds it to other people, and more people can participate and become part of our community here. So, again, thank you for that in advance if you have a moment to do that. Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi is the show name to search up on either Apple Podcasts or YouTube. Until next time, my name is Tony Bruschi. We will talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
10 hours on my feet, traffic, noise, everybody needs something from me. My head is spinning. I just need the world to stop for 1 second. But then I get home, shoes off, phone out, and I open Modo Casino. Hundreds of slots, classic table games. It's my instant reset. The variety I want in the quiet I need.
Modo Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Modo.us for more details. Download the Modo Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Modo Casino. America's social casino.
Normally in these ads, you'd expect someone like me to ask you to buy something. But I want to ask you to do something different. I'm Dave Farenthold, and I'm a reporter for the New York Times. I'm an investigative reporter, which means that I follow the money, inside of government and outside of government. The point of my job is to find things people are trying to hide. It involves talking to lots of people. It involves looking through lots and lots of documents. And if there weren't folks like me to go beyond the surface to understand who is really shaping what the government does, the public will be left in the dark about what the government's doing with your tax money, what the government's doing to you through regulations and spending. If you're like me and you think this kind of journalism is important, seek out a news source that does firsthand, fact-based reporting. If that's the New York Times, thank you. If that's your local paper, that's great too, because where you get your information matters.
Despiértate, que el $4 Breakfast Meal Deal ha llegado a McDonald's. Incluye un Sausage McMuffin o Sausage Biscuit, Hash Brown y un café caliente. Llévate más por tu dinero con tu Meal Deal. Solo por tiempo limitado. Precios y participación pueden variar. Precios con entrega pueden ser más altos.
Moro Casino. American Social Casino.
Welcome to Modo Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Modo Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Modo Casino. American Social Casino.
Download the Modo Casino app today.
Hi, Uncle Laser here. America's built on fast cars, fast food, and even faster women. Photo Casino's built in America. You know what they're fast at? Fast cash prize redemption. You see, only Moto is U.S. owned and operated. Moto, it's American made. That's who we are, and that's who we care about. Play for free at Moto.us.
Moto Casino's the social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
John Daly here. You know what day it is?
Neither do I.
I live life daily. That's why I only spin on Modo Casino. Modo's got daily free bonuses, daily tournaments, new slots added daily. And the best part? Guaranteed daily jackpots. You can't beat that. So today's the day you grip it and spin it with me on Modo, America's social casino. Play for free on Modo.us.
Modo Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Modo.us for more details. Download the Modo Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Modo Casino. America's social casino. Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
John Daly here. You know what day it is? Neither do I. I live life daily. That's why I only spend on Moto Casino. Moto's got daily free bonuses, daily tournaments, new slots added daily, and the best part, guaranteed daily jackpots. You can't beat that. So today's the day you grip it and spin it with me on Moto, America's social casino. Play for free on Moto.us.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Download the Moto Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.